So this is continuing with Christensen on 26 August 76. Continue with Mills. You were saying that you had just joined Christensen's group, and so you weren't really part of the planning for it.
I hadn't really joined his group. I joined the whole radio astronomy group, and Christensen was, along with some others, was planning this eclipse work, and he asked me to join forces with him to look after the local station while he went off, and I can't.
So I should best ask him that question.
Yeah, he'll give you the details. Yes.
So what was the next step after this experiment?
Well, it rather whetted my appetite, and the question is, what were the interesting problems at that time? And I remember discussing this at some length with Pawsey, and I think it came down to two. One was a search for hydrogen line, which he was very interested in at the time, and the other was trying to locate very precisely the positions of radio sources. And it was a difficult decision to make. I eventually chose the precise positioning because some of the techniques I was more familiar with, and it looked as if it was something which would lead to an immediate result, whereas the other was extremely speculative, whereas anything would be seen at
all. You didn't realize it was going to take you 10 or 15 years to get those precise positions and so
on? No, actually, we got some quite precise ones very quickly.
That's true for the strong sources.
Yeah, the strong ones.
I'm interested about this looking for the hydrogen line. Of course, it had been predicted by von der Holst in his famous paper, and Shlovsky also had a paper about it, which I suppose you knew about at that time. It was 48 in the Astronomische Journal.
I don't think at that time we did know about that Shlovsky paper, only the van der Holst.
Right. But what I've heard from various people is that, in fact, the Australian group was not racing with the other two groups. It was only once they'd gotten the word that had been detected in Harvard and Holland that they then slapped together receiver to...
That's perfectly true. That's what happened. Simply because I think no one really felt strongly enough about it to put the work into what we felt was, or I felt, was likely to be a rather speculative sort of thing.
Right.
And there was no certainty there'd be positive results. And there were lots of other things to be done. So.
Well, you knew the radio sources were there.
Yes, that's right.
Were the technical difficulties forbidding for the hydrogen line thing?
They appeared rather forbidding. One knew one had to get right down to the absolute maximum theoretical sensitivity, because the thing was going to be faint, probably. And as I said, after some discussion, it wasn't clear that it would be above the detectable limit.
Right.
So it was a speculative project from our point of view.
And then von der Holst,
we knew the Dutch were doing it, too.
Oh, I see.
I'm pretty sure we did know that,
And von der Holst's paper itself has said that this is only a possibility. I mean, he had not come out and said it's a sure bet.
Sure,
But now the radio sources, what was the reason that you wanted better positions at that time?
Well, as a matter of identification, there had been no... I don't think at that time there had been any clear positive identifications. I'm not even sure there had been suggestions, but Walton may have suggested the crab. I'm not sure about that. It was just about that time that the first identifications were suggested.
Right.
And it was clear that if we were to make any progress, we had to get onto these and get very, very accurate positions. And I felt that the cliff technique of rising above the sea was not a way to get accurate positions.
Because of the problems with the refraction?
Yes. So at that time, Little and Payne Scott were constructing an interferometer, a very simple one with a couple of Yagis, for observing the bursts from the sun and motions of bursts.
Right.
In fact, they were the first, I think, to observe these bursts flying out from the sun. And this equipment was available, and it appeared to me that it was a fairly simple modification. It could be used for determining the position of the strongest source we could see, Cygnus.
Right.
And so I set about doing that as my first independent job in radio astronomy.
I see. Just before we go any further, I'm interested in this talk with Pawsey. You listed two things that he suggested as possibilities. Was the idea that solar radio astronomy was important, but that was being taken care of?
Yes. Paul Wilde was looking after that at that time. But the other part was, obviously, there were a lot of things which could be done, and John Bolton was really the only one working in it at the time.
And And also, since I obviously can't talk to Pazzi, I'm also interested in how he was thinking at that time. Could you, is it possible for you to remember it all?
Well, he was intensely interested in nature as such, and physics.
Yeah.
He's one of the most dedicated people I think I have ever struck. And he, as I said, he had become interested when he'd heard of the interference during the war.
Right.
And this had stuck with him, and he, of course, knew of Reber's work by then. And he was just interested in getting at the physics of all this and finding out exactly just what was going on.
I see. So he was much more of a on the physics side than the radio engineering side, you would say.
He was, really. Yeah. He's a very competent radio engineer, particularly on antennas.
Mm-hmm.
But perhaps not quite so good on electronics.
Yeah.
But he was very competent indeed. But his real interest was in the physics of things.
Okay, well, so your first independent project, you said, was working on the Cygnus, position of Cygnus.
Yes.
And you and Thomas published a paper in 51.
Yes, a long time after the results had been obtained, I might say.
Any particular reason for that delay?
No, I don't think so. Though it was all tied up with doing a lot of other things at the same time. And I imagine both of us, both of us were quite inexperienced in doing basic physical research. We were mm-hmm. both engineers by training. And this took a bit of time to get used
to. Just how to write things up and all this sort of thing.
And we still wasted, I think is the word, a lot of time on the ionospheric effects, which were one of the things which were of considerable interest at that time. We did develop a sort of qualitative theory involving irregularities in the ionosphere, which is, I think, quite sound as far as a qualitative theory worked, but we couldn't get it onto a proper quantitative basis. And I think that was one of the main reasons for the delay in getting the paper written up.
Yeah, in the abstract it says that the fluctuations correlate with the F region. The fluctuations in Cygnus correlate with the F region.
Yes, so we did find that, but we were also interested in actually constructing a theory of how it worked. And as I said, we were not eventually successful in producing anything decently quantitative.
So it seems like you were as willing to work on the ionosphere as on what we call radio astronomy now, anyway.
Well, there were both problems, and yes, I guess I was.
Right. Maybe the distinction wasn't so clear then.
It wasn't even clear at that time when I started that the fluctuations were ionospheric in origin.
Right. Well, I'd like to hear more about that.
There was a big argument that they were inherent in the source. And, of course, this had been argued that this was a point source of radiation, a source of radiation which was fluctuating rapidly, and therefore it was a point source. But
that was in Hayes' original paper, right.
But people had realized, and I can't say who or how, I know I had knew this, that the same argument applied whether it was whether the fluctuations were inherent or imposed by the ionosphere. It still must be a point source. And we did some experiments. I know we had some with John Bolton, spaced experiments, to look for correlations at different spaces and found none. So this, I don't think this was ever written up anywhere. John Bolton may have, but it certainly showed that the stuff
There's only sort of a footnote here and there that I've been able to find on it, right?
And it showed that it was clearly not in the source, but...
Were you aware of the work going on in England at this time on the same sort of questions?
Yes. Well, we knew all the Nature publications. Most of the publications were in Nature, of course, and knew all those as soon as they came out. We'd also had some contacts with the Cavendish group.
I mean, were you aware of the work going on before it got published? Or is it just only a matter
of... Not at that particular time, although we were later.
Yeah.
Bracewell was doing a PhD at the Cavendish at that time. He'd, like me, he joined immediately on graduating with a bachelor's degree, but he went off later to get his PhD in Cambridge. And so he kept us informed, you know, what was going on, and similarly, I think he kept them over there informed on what we were doing. He was a sort of one of the sources, and Pawsey himself had contacts there. he knew was a very good friend of Ratcliffe, for instance.
Right.
And there was a lot of correspondence going on there.
Do you know if Pawsey has any sort of archives, or his widow, or anything like this?
No, I don't really know what's happened to his things. Possibly in the Academy Library. This would be the thing
to
look up.
I'll have to do some digging
when I get there, yes.
When I get there. Well, let's just look at the basic results of your Mills and Thomas 51. You got the position to 3 arc minutes, the flux measured to within 20%, less than 3% polarized, less than 10 arc minutes in size, although that had also been established, I think, before that time by Bolton's sea interferometer. Is that true, that it was less than 7 arc minutes in size or something?
Yes, I think that had been established.
And you say that the parallax was less than 1 arc minute, and therefore it must be outside the solar system,
yeah.
And so this was apparently a distinct possibility, the thing was a comet or something like that?
Yeah. Oh, before that it could have been anything.
Right. Now, did these results, what sort of light did they shed on?
There was one other interesting result there, in that we pointed out the position of a galaxy which corresponded with
That's
it.
Right. This is the first overlay, isn't it?
Yeah.
In the history of regular astronomy.
It also turned out to be the so-called colliding galaxy, which was eventually identified with. I actually wrote to Minkowski about this, pointing out the coincidence, and in typical style, Minkowski wrote back saying, no, this was an ordinary 17th or 18th magnitude galaxy, it couldn't possibly be the radio source.
Right.
We just mentioned it in the paper.
Yeah, I remember it now.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think, I've gone through this rather carefully, I don't know if you've ever done this, but your position was actually off a bit more than your errors in RA,
yeah.
I think. But your overlay also was a bit incorrect.
Yes, it was.
And this conspired such that it was still within your error box.
Well, in those days we used to use probable errors anyway, which of course made things a bit easier to get the coincidences. It was, in fact, I think, within 2 or 3 probable errors.
Right.
So it was still a reasonable identification. It was a pity, really, that he hadn't taken it more seriously and taken a proper photograph
at that
thing.
Time.
Yes.
Yeah. That would have been a year or so before, Smith position and so
forth.
So it was still a complete mystery as to what this Cygnus A thing was, I guess.
Yes, well, we felt that, and I think Minkowski helped there, that it was probably unlikely to be a galaxy so distant, because it was the strongest source and it was in the galactic plane.
Right.
And these two, you know, made us think, well, maybe this was just a coincidence.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is what Minkowski thought about it, too. It looked as if it was such a dense field there.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it looked as if it was, in fact, a galactic source because of its position in the plane.
I get the impression from reading papers at that time that most people were thinking that these were galactic sources. For instance, in the identification paper, Bolton, Stanley, and Slee, they don't seem to want to believe that 5128 is a galaxy. They say, well, it's been called a galaxy, but so-and-so has said that. Is that right, that people are sort of fighting against the idea that these things...
The term radio stars was in common use. I think actually the Cambridge people were responsible for this concept, but it caught on very strongly, and there was a very strong school of belief that these were in fact stars, the small size and, the strongest Cassiopeia and Cygnus were right on the galactic plane, and things like this made a lot of people think that in fact they were radio stars. And I think we were also affected to this by some extent.
Well,
I think I had a comment about it being unlikely that an object so large as a galaxy should be so unusual as to emit enormous quantities of radio emission, something like this.
Right. Although, were you at the stage at this time when you were actually figuring out what the intrinsic radioluminosity of such an object would be? Were you that much into the astronomy of it, so to speak, or were you just qualitatively saying, well, it would be so far away that it would be much more?
I think it was more of a qualitative argument that it was a very, very large object consisting of very many stars, and it seemed in those days that everyone was thinking in terms of local physics, fairly small objects like stars, and it just seemed inconceivable that a large object could emit a great deal. I mean, we knew the galaxy emitted radiation, but then the Cygnus one was obviously millions of times more brighter than the galaxy, and it wasn't clear how that at all.
And you weren't particularly thinking that maybe it was only the nucleus or something?
No,
the idea of nuclear activity was not there at all.
Not at all.
Right.
No.
This concept of radio star interests me. I was interested, for instance, to notice when I was at Cambridge looking through the theses that Edge's 1959 thesis, which was the 3C survey, basically, was titled A Survey of Radio Stars at 159 MHz. Yeah. Even in 1959...
That was the dogma in those days.
But I mean, then it was clearly recognized. I mean, Ryle himself in the Bakerian lecture had argued that these things were extragalactic very strongly.
Not in that... wait a bit. Wait, like, we must get the dates. Oh, yes, right. By then, yes.
Yes.
That was true.
And in 55, he was talking about cosmology.
He had a complete reversal about 55.
That's right. That's right. Mm. But that's what I'm wondering. Mm. Yet this terminology...
Yeah.
Did the term just linger on even though people realized that they weren't stars?
I would suspect only in Cambridge. We certainly didn't.
You were calling sources.
Right from the beginning, I think. I don't think I called them stars.
Yeah.
Although I was weighted towards that belief when I first joined the group, I sort of always had a niggling suspicion that they weren't, particularly in view of the possible identifications at that time with M87 and 5128. Well, M87 particularly, because, was that? I can't really remember. I think that was one of the possibles in the early days.
Oh, yeah,
M87
the three of them
and 5128.
Centaurus, Virgo, and Taurus.
Yeah. Right.
Well, let me ask about those three identifications as to the Australian group's feelings as to their certitude, so to speak. Was it seemed pretty definite that these were right, or...?
Well, the crowd looked pretty good, because, of course, that was such a peculiar galactic object anyway, and it tied in with violent events, and it looked as if it was probably good. But the others, I think, were always a bit... We always felt it in the back of our minds that they may not be exactly right. And this is one of the reasons I continued on that idea and built a bigger antennas with the idea of getting more accurate positions of a larger number of sources.
To pin it down.
Yes.
Now, M87 wasn't known to have, or at least by you anyway, to have this peculiar jet.
No.
I think there actually was a photograph way back in 1918 that some optical astronomers knew, but... I haven't heard any radio person that knew that at that time. Well, okay. Continuing with Cygnus A before we get to your first survey, there's this famous set of three papers in Nature in 1952 by the Jodrell, Cambridge, and your group on the positions and sizes of radio sources, or really more sizes.
I think that paper was the sizes at that time, yes.
And you have... Cygnus less than one arc minute, Taurus less than four, Virgo less than five, and Graham Smith has a similar sort of things for Cass and Cygnus. I wanted to ask you, what did you think when these three papers came out about this asymmetry that Hanbury, Brown, and Jennison had with their entirely different technique? You know, they came out strongly saying that the thing is very elongated.
Did they at that time?
Yeah,
they
didn't have the double quite yet, but they said that it was four by one or something like that.
I see, I'd forgotten that one. I can't remember too clearly the details of that. We had just got our radio link interferometer going, and these were very much the preliminary results with it. And the interesting thing, as far as I was concerned, was that they were all resolved. As I said, they were not stars. And I remember, in fact, at that time, I remember bringing this to Piddington's attention because he was still tending to think in terms of stars. And I remember commenting that, well, these were quite clearly no longer, well, not stars. We had to think in terms of galaxies rather than stars. I mean, that really convinced me.
I guess Bracewell was backed by then, or was he? Because he has this nice little paper in Observatory, Radio Stars or Radio Nebulae, question
mark. Oh, yes, he'd come back and was discussing this with us at the time. And, of course, we had also measured angular sizes of some other sources, such as Centaurus A, which we found to be very large.
And Fornax.
Fornax, too.
Right.
This had been done with our other interferometer, which we had constructed for the survey. So that, in fact, was the... I think the first... Oh, no. Let me see. Smith had built a three-element interferometer for this measurement of signals, but we also had this three-element interferometer going, which measured these large sources.
Right.
So we had the general picture, and I think this is what struck Bracewell when he came back, that our concept of the universe was different from the Cambridge one. They thought in terms of point sources uniformly scattered over the sky, radio stars, in fact. And we had in the south, we had measured all these large angular sizes, and it was obviously much more complex than this. And that has been one of the sources of the difference between us and our outlook. I think it's just by chance that the northern ones are smaller than the southern.
Conspiracy of nature.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, there were Centaurus and Cygnus, which Graham Smith himself measured to have finite sizes.
Cygnus and Cassiopeia. And he had measured Centaurus as a southern object.
I said Taurus.
Taurus, I'm sorry.
I forget if he measured all three of those.
Correct, yes.
I think he did. I think he measured Taurus and Cass, is what he did.
And Cygnus.
Probably Cygnus.
No, I can't remember. We'll have to look that up. I know he measured Cygnus and Cass. So
anyway, is it your view that these were sort of looked on as aberrations by the Cambridge group?
I don't know.
The couple strongest?
I can't remember at that time. I think there were... Cass and the Crab were definitely thought of as being galactic things, and I'm not sure about what they thought about Cygnus.
Well, I'm going to try to get Graham Smith this meeting, too.
Yes, he may be able to help you on that one. It was a...
But what about this new intensity interferometer technique? Was that your first knowledge of it when you saw this one-page thing in Nature?
Oh, no. Yeah. We all those came out together in Nature.
Right.
And we'd heard about it quite some time ago when they were first getting going from people who'd been traveling around and written back the news of what they were doing. So we knew they were doing this particular job. And during the 52 ERSI meeting in Sydney, both Graham Smith and Hanbury Brown were there, and we got together and talked about all these things.
These papers came out of that meeting,
and
more or less,
yes, yeah. So that's why they were all published together. We organized a joint publication or more. And as I said, we were not seriously concerned about the difference in sizes or shapes that we got, since it was obvious that we had only done a fairly coarse sampling of the stuff. And
although I think that, once again, if I had the paper here, I could verify this, but I think that this is the paper that you had several spacings, didn't you?
Yes.
And if you put a couple more in, you could have gotten the double nature.
Yes, I could have. Yes. It was unfortunate.
This is famous looking back retroactively.
Yeah. I did all my interpretations on the basis of some sort of Gaussian distribution.
Right. Well, if you have no other evidence,
it fitted,
sure. But still, you haven't said what you thought about this intensity interferometer. I mean, did it make sense to you that this worked?
That was no... I think we did understand roughly how it worked. I mean, physically we knew it must work, but I think we were a bit unhappy about sensitivities. Hanbury, Brown and Twiss had made were quite clear on this, that it wasn't a very sensitive instrument.
Right.
They could only see the bright things, and... we had discussed it during the ERSI meeting, as I said, and we were quite, no worries about it working at all. It was only the quantum physicists who were worried about it working, I think. The radio engineers were perfectly happy.
Right, there was quite a debate later on, as you know. Since you brought it up, let me just ask about that 52 ERSI meeting in Sydney. Is it true to say that this was held in Sydney in recognition of the Australian radio astronomy, or was it radio and ionospheric work?
I think I was too young and obscure in those days to know the basis of the meeting. You see, it would have been decided a few years before to hold it in Australia, but I think the ionospheric work would have weighed heavily too, because Australia did have a pretty strong ionospheric school in those days, and I think both together would have counted.
Do you have any recollections of that meeting as sort of the atmosphere that was there? That must have been sort of a really exciting time.
Yes, it was.
Things were popping all over.
Yes. I have quite a few odd flashbacks here and there.
Well, anecdotes are always appreciated, so any flashbacks are welcome.
Well, I don't really know that there would be of any great use. I remember discussions with both Graham Smith and Hanbury Brown about some of their work, about some of the ionospheric details, ionospheric fluctuations and how they work. I remember Hanbury visiting our angular size interferometer, radio link interferometer, and having to be convinced that would work all right, given the effects of very large separations between the antennas and the delays which had to be corrected for and things right. like this. So it was a very pleasant time. My main thing I got out of it, I think, was meeting for the first time a lot of these people.
All these names.
Because we'd been very isolated in Australia and corresponded with a few of them. Not actually met them before, so that was definitely
well. That's an important point, I think. You've mentioned a couple of people like Fawzi and Bracewell that had mixed, but most of the Australians had not.
That's right.
Traveled. Yes. I guess Frank Kerr is another case of one who had gone to the outside world, so to speak. He went to Harvard in 51 for a year.
51.
He was actually there when the hydrogen line was discovered.
I'd forgotten that. Mm.
But would you say that this perhaps contributed to a Australian radio astronomy developing rather independently? If it had been in a European country, it might have.
Yes, I think it did. We did have, I think, quite an independent outlook, really. Yeah. We had no famous names to tell us what we should believe, and we just went ahead following our noses to some extent. We did have quite a good technique. This was the main thing that I think that's got things going. Of course, this is a pretty obvious statement, and lots of people have made it. I think our radio techniques were well up to anyone else, because radar, as a result of the war, was an international subject in which practically all countries were not exactly equivalent, but at least moderately so.
Although, of course, radio astronomy did not take off in the U.S., where there was as much technique and much more money.
It could have done.
It could have, right.
Yes.
Do you have any ideas as to why it didn't? I keep asking everyone.
I think
you'll
have to ask the Americans. I have no idea.
Well,
I know why it did in Australia, and that was because we had the radio physics laboratory, which had now its raison d'etre was finished.
Right.
It was no longer required for radar, at least for wartime radar. We had to find something to do in a hurry, and it was, I think, this reason which led Dr. Bowen, who was then head, to press strongly for radio astronomy once Fawzi had got it going, because this was a field which, you see, we might have got sucked into doing standards for television or something horrible like that. And it was just the sort of, we had a lab which was well set up for doing radio work of all kinds, and it was just a matter of trying all the things which we could. You see, this linear accelerator I mentioned earlier was one of the things we had a go at as being a possible good line of development. Again, Bowen pushed this very hard. And it was only when it was realized that the expense would be too much for us that we dropped it.
Although, of course, you had the radiation lab at MIT. If that had kept going, I suppose.
Yes.
I don't really know. I suppose it was some governmental decision that this was going to be. It was disbanded incredibly quickly.
Yeah.
And maybe that can be blamed in some part.
Yeah, I think that probably did have a large part to do with America not getting onto radio astronomy so quickly.
Let me pick you up on that comment about you didn't have experts to tell you what to think, because it seems to me like there were as many experts in radio astronomy in Australia as there were in England.
Oh, no. I was talking about experts in astrophysics and astronomy.
Oh, in astronomy.
Yes, another.
Well, who exactly are you referring to in astronomy?
Well,
seems to me
I think the classical astronomers generally had rather tended to hold back radio astronomy. And this is what I had in mind,
I see.
Really.
I see what you're saying, yes.
Because the general idea was that they knew what was in the sky, and you shouldn't try and look for things which are not there.
Right, and if you can't only tell me where they are within a degree, then
it's not much good doing it, yes. And that was a very common outlook, but we were less afflicted by it than many other groups, I think.
Although, obviously, some groups just didn't let this bother them.
Oh, yes, sure. Well, they were the groups that forged ahead.
Right. Okay. Well, we now come... Well, let me ask about the whole radio link technique, because I think that you were the first to really develop this, were you not?
I think so, yeah.
Interferometry. Can you sort of tell me how this came about?
Well, I better do the thing historically.
Yes.
Following on measurements on Cygnus, which were done with a couple of Yagis, or rather three Yagis now I come to think of it. We did have three. There was one with a short spacing for resolving ambiguities. We decided we had to have larger area, and so I constructed the next system. This time Thomas, who'd been working with me, left for England, and Arthur Watkinson, as a technician, came in to help me on this, and we got some land quite a long way away. We had to abandon the field station we had because it wasn't large enough and there was too much interference. So we went out about to Badgery's Creek, which is a little bit further than our eventual Fleurs station, which we still have now.
Right. What was the name of the first one you were at?
Potts Hill.
Right.
That's the Potts Hill Reservoir. And this was about 30 miles west of Sydney. It was the nearest we could find, and the reason we chose it basically was that it was on CSIRO property. It was one of the experimental farms.
Mm-hmm.
So we set up there with a much larger, but still by modern standards quite small, antenna system consisting of a few arrays of dipoles and a fairly complex calibration system, which again followed on the technique we had been using before, which had been originally developed by Payne Scott and Little. And we did our surveys there and plus position measurements. But while we were doing this, we found these large angular size sources, and the question arose naturally that there's undoubtedly be a distribution of sizes, and we knew of the possible identifications, and we thought things would be several minutes of arc would be sort of sizes we'd be interested in,
right.
A minute of arc up sort of thing. And there was this debate about whether there were radio stars or radio galaxies, and quite obviously the way to determine this was to build an interferometer which could distinguish whether things were smaller or greater than about a minute of arc. And this was the sort of thing I was going to do. And you look at the spacing, we're still thinking in terms of low frequencies, which is all we could use in those days because of the sensitivity question.
Right.
And obviously you needed things up to about 10 kilometers.
Right, and you were becoming aware of the steep spectrum, I suppose,
yes,
at this time.
Yes, we had already, Walton and Slee had done some measurements on spectra, and although they disagreed again with the Cambridge ones, I think, they showed a steep slope, and we believed those. And so it was clear that one had to keep at low frequencies, and you had to go to a very large spacing. And it was equally clear we couldn't afford the cable to do it, and I was quite familiar with the techniques necessary to make a radio link.
Mm-hmm.
So I just looked into the problems and decided the worst problem was that of getting a stable compensating delay for the long path length
right.
to the distant antenna. And there my experience in digital computing was very useful because our computer, following on the original British design, had a mercury delay lines for store.
Oh, yes.
So I just borrowed a couple of these delay lines and used them as a variable delay for compensation. So everything sort of fitted together on that one.
Were you using these computers at all in your reduction of
data?
Oh,
no. They are purely experimental.
Yeah.
They're very slow by modern techniques.
But still faster than your hand.
Oh, very,
thing,
very
if
much
you know
faster,
it.
Yes.
No, no. So, do I have it right then? It was just a matter of expense, really, that made you go to the microwave link, not a matter of too much attenuation over such a
long length? Well, it was also the practical convenience of it. If we wanted to try different spacings in different places, then obviously you couldn't go coiling and uncoiling miles of cable.
Right.
So the radio link was the obvious way of doing it. As I said, I knew the techniques were adequate, and the only real thing was I was worried about was getting this compensating delay, which I realized was necessary. Even that wasn't too certain in those days, because we looked at, I remember looking at how narrow the bandwidth would have to be in order to get fringes over the spacing, and decided just too narrow, so that then occurred to me to put in this delay. So.
These sort of things were not written in textbooks, obviously.
No, never, or in papers.
Right.
It had to be thought out right from scratch.
Right. So what was the first thing that was done with this this radio link interferometer?
We did our first measurements with a very short baseline just to see if it would work. And on all the stronger sources, we got it going on a short baseline, and we stepped out, I think, to a kilometer, and I think 5 kilometers, and noting that the three stronger ones, the Crab, M87, and 5128, all dropped off after they were dropping off at 1, and were completely invisible at 5, and I'm not sure how much they dropped off at 1 kilometer. I'd have to look at the paper to remember that. And then at 5 kilometers, the Cygnus A had dropped off quite a bit. And at one, there'd been no drop off. So we'd had a constant visibility to 1 kilometer. These are just orders of magnitude,
of course.
On Cygnus A, and then a big drop by the time we got to 5 kilometers. And then on the others, it had been dropping off much more rapidly. So that was it.
What were you using to calibrate your fringes, your fringe amplitude?
We injected noise, if I remember correctly. I can't remember the exact calibration technique used in the first system. I think that...
It seemed to me this would be a problem.
Yes, yes and no. You see, we're not after an accurate measurement.
Well, you still want to know whether it's 0.7 or 0.9 or...
No, that wasn't necessary at all. What you want to do is to take it out until it drops off to zero, or drops off a long way, and that gives you the size.
Oh, okay, right.
I mean, we had the original Michelson concept in this, that it was a matter of fringe visibility, and you wait till it goes right down, and then it doesn't matter very much about your calibration. So I can't really remember. I don't think I know we were not worried about it, and I don't think we had anything very elaborate.
Okay. And that was the paper that, the first thing that published on it was one of those three papers in Nature,
yes,
52,
yeah.
Right? And the more accurate, or the more complete work was also in 52 in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research. I suspect that's right.
Was that 53? No, it's 53. The main radio link one came out, I think.
Well,
52 was our.
He had six accurate positions. Oh, was that from the survey?
That was from the survey.
Okay, I'm confused then.
Yeah.
To keep things in chronological order here, let's go to your first survey then.
Yes. Well, that had in fact been done before the angular size work.
I see.
That was done around about 1950.
And it was published about the same time.
That first angular size work wouldn't have come out at all at that time, but for the stimulation of the 52 ERSI meeting and our decision to publish all our results together.
I see.
And they were very preliminary. It would have been this 53 one alone which published otherwise.
Well, let's go back to the survey with the Michelson interferometer.
Yeah.
Which was the first southern survey, basically. Well, is that right?
Bolton and Slee had done a survey.
They had how many sources, roughly? 22 or something like that?
I can't remember
sticks
the number.
In my mind, but you had many more, anyway.
Yes,
77 here.
Yes, that's right.
And, I guess the first thing to ask is what was the difference between your two surveys?
There was very little contact between Bolton's group and mine. They were, we each felt rather strongly our own technique was the best, and although we saw each other sometimes. Bolton lived out in Dover Heights.
I see.
And Harlan didn't come into the lab very often, and I spent most of my time out at Potts Hill, out at Badgery's Creek. So as you can see, we didn't have very much contact, actually, and quite a few arguments about interpretation of results and things like that.
And Fawzi was quite willing to...
Oh, yes. He
let both these go on and see...
Yeah. He thought it was a very healthy situation, I think.
Okay.
And so this was quite independent of anything Bolton had done. I can't even remember when he did his and when he published it.
It was about the same time, I think. So it was about the same frequency, 100 megahertz?
Yes, also? It was about the same frequency, yes.
And neither of you did, well, I can't remember if you did in print anyway, a comparison of these surveys to...
No. He may have. I know we had written ours up well before he had written his up. At least I think we had. It was at least before his were published. The survey results were prepared independently,
okay.
Basically.
Well, maybe I'll have to do that comparison.
You may. The thing which we did agree on was the fact that the sources had angular sizes. And we in fact, had found this first at Badgery's Creek, at 5128. And then Walton found the same sort of thing on his C interferometer, and we agreed on at least on that part of it. But my memory is that we did our survey and got our results out and largely written up before Bolton had got back onto his. But I'm not.
I think I have both those papers back in my hotel room, so maybe I can check that.
That could be wrong. I wouldn't stick by it.
Right. Now, what were the main results of this survey? Would you say?
Oh well, it was really there came in two things. There were the positions and the that I'll talk about later, and the actual results of the survey itself. And there, I think, the important things were that we recognized that there must be two classes of source because of the strong sources being distributed along the plane and the weak ones isotropically. Now, at that time, we couldn't be sure that the isotropic sources were extragalactic, but we felt pretty confident that they were, and I think if you read that paper on that survey that I wrote, you'll find that I was being rather careful not to commit myself completely to one or the other.
But you're leaning...
I was leaning towards the other because of the fact that it was of these identifications. And I think that was the important thing that came out of the survey itself. This was... I know, debated quite a lot in England by people who had gone overseas, and Fawzi was often touring around, for instance.
Right.
And at that time, the extragalactic-galactic argument was building up and getting quite strong and heated at times.
Now, these were the Class 1 and Class 2 sources that you referred to,
these two
distributions.
Yes.
This terminology, I think, was used throughout the 50s, really, wasn't it?
Yes, it was, yes.
Now, the 1C survey came out a bit before yours. You probably saw that.
Oh, yes, that was one of the early ones.
It was 1950 it was published.
Was it?
Yeah.
We may have had the results of that earlier. I think we did, actually. It came. I know that about the time I was working on this, there was a Ryle survey. Ryle and Ellsmore, I think it was.
That's the one, right.
Yes, and there was Bolton and Slee survey, initial survey, were both available.
But now, Ryle, Smith and Ellsmore, I think it was. Came out with an isotropic distribution. Why did they not come up with...
Oh, well, that actually is one of the sources of our whole difference of our outlook. They missed the strong sources near the plane because they were using wide-spaced interferometers.
Right.
And so therefore they divided the sky into a slowly varying component and point sources. Whereas we, by having our close spacing, were able to see these